Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 5 for Autumn Semester 2018. Lecture 4, delivered on August 30, 2018. The title of this lecture is Types of Markets.
Today, types of markets. When I do this, I can divide markets up into so many different kinds of markets. Physical markets versus financial markets. Short-term markets versus long-term markets, Dutch auction markets versus sealed bid versus English auction markets. I mean, it's up and down all over the place. You can talk about different types of markets. Markets for corporate debt versus markets for consumer debt versus markets for government debt. I mean, there are just so many different ways that you can chop up the market. One thing that I do want to begin with, though, is reintroducing the difference between a money market and a capital market. Now, money markets are markets for short-term financing. Capital markets are long-term. When I say short-term, a year or less. So you, sir, come to me and say, I need to borrow $100. Well, that's okay. We might be able to talk about it. But that would be for how long? Oh, until I get paid next week. Oh, okay. Well, that would be a money market transaction. And it would also be a direct transaction. The money person and the money supplier and the money needer are coming together right away. Now, there are several kinds of indirect. There are indirect through financial services, like companies, like banks. And there are so many different kinds of banks, it's ridiculous. And then there are markets that are more formalized for corporate money. Those are called investment banks. Now, investment banks, your Facebook, and you want to do that IPO you did, you're not going to sell that stock to the public. You're going to come to an investment bank. And that investment bank is going to say, okay, we will firm underwrite your offering. We'll buy it from you. We'll buy the whole issue of Facebook stock you're trying to sell. And I'll put together a syndicate of other investment banks to do this. And then we'll sell it to our customers, to our clients. But you get your money from us. That's an investment bank. They're highly specialized. That's their job. And I have former students who work in investment banks. So when Facebook went public, it really just sold all of its stock in an agreed-upon fashion to a group of heavy Wall Street banks called investment banks. And then they sold the stock to their clients. And I'd sell it to you, one of my best clients. Then we'd hype the stock up, push the stock up, and then when we had gotten that stock nice and high, we'd sell it for you to you who are a sucker. And then the price would just boom like that. We take care of Facebook. We take care of our wealthy clients. And then we'd leave you slobs. I just bought Facebook. Sure, its price just fell a whole lot, but I bought Facebook. Well, yeah, good for you. You bought some martinis for us on Wall Street. Anyway, money markets. Short-term money. Now, I usually spend a few minutes telling you about these money markets. They are generally, let me give you an example of a money market. They are huge, vast pools of money, and they are so critical to the functioning of businesses. One example, a good example of a money market that is one of the ways that the retail world lives is through floor planning, cash management. Imagine that you are, and speaking from one personal experience in my long ago past, I had a brother. He's dead now. Never liked me too much, but he ran a boat dealership. Every winter, he would go to a bank. He had a relationship with a bank. The bank would provide him the money so that he could buy boats and put them on his showroom floor. And then as the boating season moved into full gear, people would come into his store, his shop, and buy boats. So in other words, he foreplanned. He got money up front to lay in the inventory, and then he sold it through the year. Furniture stores do exactly the same thing. Car dealerships do the same thing. They get a large amount of money to put the inventory on the floor of the shop, and then they would sell that and pay off the bill that way. A much more, a much even larger version of that happens with most retailers. I got to be a little careful, but most. Most retailers have the vast majority of their revenue come in during a 2 to 3 month period. What is that period? Do you know? Christmas season. The rest of the year, you got almost nothing. You are going to sell Christmas as hard as you can. And you are going to sell Christmas. Hell, if you don't have your Christmas decorations up in your store right now, you're a little behind the ball. Oh, they're ruining Christmas by putting everything up in September and October. No, we got to get the revenue. We got to get you in the Christmas spirit. We got to get you to believe in Santa Claus and love your family and buy so that they'll love you back. That's the reality of it. It's sad, isn't it? But hey, we're capitalists. And so, in other words, what goes on in those businesses, you have a relationship with a bank or a set of banks, and it's called a cash management account. Essentially, they set up a line of credit with you at the beginning of each year, and like $500,000. Okay, through the year, you are paying your employees, paying your light bills, taking care of building inventory through the year, and just borrowing the money, just writing checks on that working capital account. And then, as the Christmas season begins to rise, you start getting revenues coming in good and hard. And then you're paying down that line of credit. And you hope, by the end of the year, you've paid off the whole line of credit. And you start the same process over again. Year after year after year, you do this. This is how most businesses work. In my business, my selling season is late spring through early autumn as an artist. Okay, so in other words, I'm borrowing money starting in about November. I have some Christmas orders come in. I have a line of credit, and I just borrow the money. I build my inventory, buying the framing, the museum glass, the printing, and all that kind of stuff. And then I have everything ready so that I start going to the shows. And then at the shows, I hope to God I can sell so that I can start paying off the credit line that I've accumulated with the credit amount that I've accumulated, getting to the point where I could sell the merchandise. And here's another reality of that, too. When you're in the business let's start this. The numbers vary from company to company. Have you ever noticed that when you go into a store, like a Kohl's or something like that, there are a lot of clothes there? You ever notice that there are so many clothes, so many sizes, so many colors, so many styles? Most of that is not going to sell. It's not. You have to, for every one you sell, you probably will have 10 that never sell. You've got to give the consumers that choice. You've got to price so that one covers 10. That's how it works. And you just run your business that way because you've got to pay off your bills. If your shareholders want a dime of money, you got to get your bills paid before you can give them that dime. So that's one of the realities of the money markets. It is this way. It just works this way. I'm trying to decide if I should tell you about, in your lifetimes, when you were about 10 years old, Western civilization almost crashed into the ground in complete ashes. I don't know if I should tell you about that, but it was a money market thing. I'm trying to think if I should tell you. Nah, I'll let you. It'd be better if you did. Well, okay. Now, in June of 2008, there were clear signs to analysts like me that something was terribly, terribly wrong. We were writing these articles that made us look like idiots, conspiracy theorists. There's going to be an apocalypse of the markets. Oh, God, it's coming, it's coming. And I published mine. Can't remember the title of the article. But anyway, there were others saying that something horrible is going to happen. And I was projecting that it would happen sometime around the beginning of autumn or possibly as late as Thanksgiving. Nothing seemed to be coming of it. Then there was this morning, September the 15th, 2008. Now, the Federal Reserve, our central bank, keeps an eye on all the flows of capital and money running around in the banking system. That's their job. But something strange was happening when the banks were opening on the East Coast that morning. Huge withdrawals from the money market accounts. In other words, the short-term accounts. And I'm not talking hundreds of millions. I'm talking billions of dollars were being pulled out of, withdrawn out of these money market, these huge money market accounts. It was happening at banks all up and down the East Coast, the Eastern time zone. It was anomalous, and it was very strong, pulling billions and billions. These banks have to have liquidity. And if they don't have liquidity, they can't honor your checks. They can't process your debit card transactions. The liquidity was being drained at a staggering rate. By about 9:30, analysts at the Federal Reserve were calling the Board of Governors. It was that serious. The seven top dogs of the Federal Reserve saying, we have got a real problem. Something has gone really wrong. And the Board of Governors met over the phone. And by the time they had made it, they had seen how severe it was 10 o'clock. And by 10 o'clock, out of the money markets, this is the amount of money that had been pulled. That much. A staggering amount. And it was already beginning to affect the banks in the Midwest as the time clock moved forward into the Midwestern time zone. And it was about to cross into the Mountain time zone. And it was from there. By that time, the banks on the East Coast would fold. If it got to the West Coast, they would have just completely folded like a house of cards, and it would have been a domino effect. And then as the sun clocked up around all over into Asia, those banks would have collapsed too because of the liquidity crisis that was being created in the United States. And by the time the day was over, the entire Western system of banking would have been gone. Your paycheck would no longer have been accessible in your account, direct deposit. It's so easy, isn't it? And then suddenly you don't have it anymore. Your debit cards wouldn't have worked. Nothing would have functioned because the liquidity, essentially the oil in the engine would have all drained out and the engine would have just gone, seized up. The Fed at 10 o'clock declared an emergency and banned all transactions withdrawing money from money market accounts. A session of Congress was called a special emergency session. The chairman of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, and the Treasury Secretary, Hank Paulson, went to the House of Representatives. They closed the doors and locked them. At that point, one kind of crazy representative, Jeff Sessions, asked the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, he said, are we under martial law here? She didn't answer him. She didn't even answer him. And they explained what they knew about it. what they had done to stop it, and essentially from there, the economy crashed into the greatest recession since the Great Depression. That was 2008 in September. And most people don't know how close we came. About 2-3 hours from the end of Western civilization as we understand it, with its dependence upon financial markets. So there you go. It's over now. We're never going to do that again, except that everything that was wrong with the markets then is now magnified. Deregulation has proceeded, just like it had before that crash. And so we're in a situation very similar to that now. Is it going to happen again? Well, I don't really care. I'll be dead. Money markets. Now, there are other money markets, too. There are all kinds of money markets. The government borrows money short-term, just like companies borrow money short-term. There are also very formalized ways that corporations borrow short-term money. There is a kind of corporate borrowing. Large creditworthy corporations need money for very short periods of time, 30 days. There's a formal security for this. It is called commercial paper. Commercial paper is essentially a 30-day loan from a short-term, very wealthy investor to a company that needs short-term money. So, for example, commercial paper might be some big, huge corporation says, in 30 days, we will pay you $10 million. And so there is a lender or that will lend them, let's say, $9,980,000. That's called discount paper. In other words, it's borrowed at a discount to its par value. And that's fairly common. And the interest that you make, in this case, $20,000, would be the interest yield on it taken over a year. Now, there are investors who want to lend short-term, and there are investors who want to lend long-term. Short-term investors, this is a huge market, I mean an enormous market, the commercial paper market. It's highly formalized. It's just essentially you do it. Now, it's very safe. These are large creditworthy corporations, but every once in a while, a scoundrel corporation starts playing too hard in the commercial paper market, and it rattles the market when they default. A good example of that would be a company from the early 2000s. I think it was the early 2000s. Have you ever heard of a company called Enron? Yeah, Enron. The top dogs of that company were just siphoning money off and sending it to their offshore accounts in the Dutch Antilles, the Seychelles, places like that. They were just funneling the money off, the profit. And as the company was, and they were also doing some other really, really evil things that had nothing to do with that. But near the end of the life, these big dogs, they knew the company was going to fold any day. So what did they do? They issued commercial paper. And they took that and they put that into their accounts offshore. You know, that really takes, you know, the technical term in Spanish would be cayones to do that, to play that hard. But Enron, that was just one of the nasty things. They were also, Enron, one of my, many, many years ago, he was my fellow PhD student at Ohio State. He was actually one of the energy traders in a real scam. Enron was selling electricity into California and then rerouting the electricity back out of California to Nevada and then selling it again to Nevada or to some other state, including California. They were just recycling electrons and selling them over and over again. Now, that's pretty awesome. California was having blackouts and brownouts, and everyone was saying, well, it's this or that or that. No one understood financial markets enough to know that this was commodity trading on electrons. And there was this, essentially, they were churning the asset that they were selling, electricity. They were churning it. It's a classic thing to do, but with electricity, who would have thought that anyone would do that? Well, Enron did. Anyway, he spent a few years, well, the guy I knew, he spent a few years in prison, but he also had an offshore account they never got to, so he's all good. Son of a bitch. No, I kid you not. Anyway, money markets. Now, there are other things, too. Here's an interesting one. And this comes, again, I tell you a lot of stories from my own life. This is something that had been done for many, many, many decades. But it was only very large companies that did this trick. It's technical. Well, to tell you a story, I was teaching out in Dayton at Wright State University, and I got to know some business people in town. There was one, he ran his little insurance agency. You know, they set up the insurance for mom and dad's cars and the homeowner's insurance, renter's insurance, things like that, boat insurance. And they would always have money come in during the day, and I was there one later afternoon, and his finance assistant, she was getting all the checks in. People come in, they bring their checks in back in that time in the 1980s for their premiums, for their auto insurance or whatever. So she had this pile of checks. She even had cash, and she was just rushing real fast, and she said something like, well, I got to get to the bank before it closes to put my money into the bank account. Yeah, and so the owner of the company, the guy I knew, Larry, he said, yeah, we can't miss the sweep. And it didn't dawn on me right away. He said the word sweep. And suddenly it hit me. I said, Larry, did you say sweep? Yeah. I said, Larry, this is a very small company. What bank are you using that does sweeps for small-time players? Well, I thought they all did it. I said, no, not now. Now, since then, it has become very common. Here's how a sweep works. Let's say you own a bakery, okay? Your bakery is open from 8 to 5. You make excellent pastries, although that one, you know, that apple turnover is a little flaky, but then again, so am I, so I eat it. You know. More cream cheese next time. Okay, but at the end of the day, you take your money and you take it to the bank and you put it in the bank. You're not going to need your money until tomorrow morning when you go back to the bank and get your bag of money and you should really have an armed guard, you know, but what do? You take cream pies, so if someone tries to steal your stuff, you hit them with a cream pie. Yeah, that's cool. Okay, but now there from 5 in the afternoon until 8 o'clock the next morning, your money just sits there. But with a very large corporation, it doesn't. The money, as soon as 5 o'clock comes, you get your deposit in there, your money is swept out in a sweep into this giant world account with all of these millions of other businesses, their money. So during the night, and remember the world is 24 hours, there is this giant bladder of money, money flowing in as companies around the world at their closing times feed money into this giant liquidity balloon. And then there are also companies, as their business days are starting, money's pulling out of the balloon. But at any given time, this thing has hundreds of billions of dollars in it. That's liquidity for the currency traders, the commodity traders, for all of those players that need very, very short-term money to keep the markets discovering price equilibrium. And this is happening every day all over the world. The sweeps are feeding into this bladder of liquidity that keeps our world rolling forward at the insane pace that it is. And hardly anyone has any idea that this flow of capital is happening all around us. Not flow of capital, this flow of money. This isn't capital, this is short term. So when Larry gets his money in the morning, it's been busy all night. It's like I have this cat. The one cat sneaks out at night, comes back in the morning. Where the hell have you been, cat? And the cat, nah, I'm going to lie down. Fix me some breakfast. You don't know what that money's done. It could have provided liquidity for a currency trade on yuan against yen or something like that. Or it could have provided this quick liquidity for a commodities movement that happened somewhere. Go ahead.
What do you get out of it?
So interest. See, that's what happens is my cat comes back. Well, the cat's got my interest. I want to know what he did. He doesn't tell me, but he's got my interest. So,
guaranteed?
The cat guaranteed?
The cash.
Back. Oh, I thought you meant my cat. My cat's guaranteed because I feed it. But the deal is, yeah, it's a certain amount of money, and it's not so much guaranteed, but you know you're going to get something. Let's put it this way. You can have nothing, and your money sits there quietly and happily.
No, or you can...
Oh, yeah, you'll get it back. You'll get it back. It's,
what is the minimum I can spend doing that? Like a small business, $100,000. You said it used to be
extremely. Yeah, and see, in Larry's business, from what I knew, and this was back then, I would have known this for large, large retailers like Walmart or banks would do it with their liquidity. That's called the overnight funds market. His was no more than like $50,000 on any, at max, on any given deposit. More likely it was about $10,000. And so if you're going to join in that kind of a program, you first of all have to know how to ask the right questions, because otherwise they're just going to look at you and pretend that you're stupid. And then you have to know who... Huh? Oh, no. I mean, it's like a lot of things. If I go in and I talk like a hillbilly, I'm not going to get anywhere. But then I say, oh, by the way, I'm a professor of finance. Let's try this again. Suddenly, oh, I know what you're talking about. Well, you did before, but you were bluffing me, kind of thing. So you have to know how to ask. You also can't go in there, I got $12, and I want that into a suite.
Exactly what I
want
to do.
Well, it ain't going to happen. Ain't going to happen at all. It's like I went to these restaurants where they don't have any prices on the menu. That doesn't mean the food is free. I found that out the hard way. But yeah, it's got to be enough money that it's worth their while to put it into the ball. So many banks now participate. They have, and even if you're not participating in a sweep, you think they're leaving your money where it is? No, they're doing it on their own. And that can be a lot of money. Let me give you an example of how nasty this can be. Did you know that when you buy your gas, oh, you don't have to go inside, just put your credit card in the slot, and then isn't this convenient? Did you know that many of those oil companies actually lock in more than you're going to buy? Good example of that. You buy $50 worth, you say, you put your card in. Okay, what they're going to do is they're going to lock $100. Well, obviously, we have to put a lock enough to, you know, for you to make your purchase. And then you get $50 worth of gas. Do you think that you get that $50 back into your account right away? No. They'll keep it 3 to 5 days. And then they earn money. So imagine a small chain of gas stations. 10,000 customers a day. They're pulling in $50 from, let's say, 10,000 customers a day, and they're holding that money for 5 days. So on the back end, there's money flowing back into the people's credit card accounts, but in the front end, that same amount of money is going in. And so on any given day, what's 50? Oh, that's a lot of money. Yes.
Why don't I see that on any sort of credit statements?
Because you don't need to know that. I found out the hard way with Murphy Oil when I needed $10 worth of gas, so I put my debit card in there a few years back. And then when I went to buy food with what was left on my debit card, I couldn't buy anything because they'd locked the entire amount, which was about $60. And I called and I raised holy hell. And they said, oh, it'll be back in your account on Monday. You know, bitch, I gotta eat. You know. You understand? Exactly. Don't be stupid. because they're going to play, it's called playing the float. I have my European art agency. They will sell a work of my art in Europe, and then I will see the money 60 days later. Oh, it's all this complications of currency trade exchange rates and all that. Oh, don't give me that, you French hoe handle. You're taking my money, you're keeping it, you're earning interest on it, you're playing the float. Okay? That's what it's called. It's called playing the float. And these are money markets. Everything I've told you is a money market. I haven't even bothered to tell you about the capital markets. Let me tell you about one other money market. Payday loans. Those places where you can go and you need money for just a week or two. Great. I mean, I've used them. Pawn shops are the same thing. Let me show you how it works, and I'm going to sneak in some financial math on you. Now, don't have a cow. I'll show you this again. Like I say, I show things over and over again. But let's say a payday loan place, one of those kinds of places. You go in there, and you write them a check. I need to borrow $200. Okay, that's $200. And so they say, well, write us a check, and we'll cash it 2 weeks later. Well, how nice is that? When your payday, when your paycheck comes in, you'll be able to cover it. So they're going to give you your $200, but they're going to say, okay, we have to charge you interest. We're like a bank. Well, how much are you going to charge me? Well, the annual percentage rate is 19.95%. Seems steep, but this is only for 2 weeks. Okay? So it's really not that bad. Because for 2 weeks, that would be divided by 26 two-week periods in a year, okay? So let's look that up real quick here. I grab this. Ouch, I hurt something I care about. Shut up. Really? Okay, so what we would do here is I would take the $200 times 0.1995 divided by 26. Whoops, let me do that again. 0.1995 divided by 26. So another. You know what? No, I'll keep working this dog until 0.1995 divided by 26. Are you happy? Oh, shut up. Okay. So look, that interest rate is only 0.767%. And so we times that by $200. So that's $1.53. I mean, where could you go wrong with that? So all you're going to pay, oh, don't write it for $200. You got to write it for $200 plus your interest, which is $1.54. Well, that's not horrible at all. Yeah, let me get that. Oh, wait. We got a processing fee of $25. So you got to add that in there. And, of course, we've got to do a credit check fee on you for $10. So you write your check to us for $236.54. All right, yeah. Well, that's still not so bad. I got my $200. I got my cheeseburgers tonight. Well, let's look at what the annual interest rate. Remember that in finance, we want to annualize all interest rates so we can compare different yields on different instruments. Now, here's how you do it. And again, I'm going to show this to you again, so don't have a cow. The way you annualize any yield is you take the ending value over the beginning value and you raise it to the 1 over the number of years, minus 1. And then you times it by 104%. Now, don't sweat this. So in other words, if it were 2 years, I'd do it to the 1 over 2. If it were for a half year, I'd do it to the 1 over 0.5. In this case, say that again. That's annualizing interest rate, annualizing it. Now, in this case, it's a little trickier because you're asking, how many years are there in a two-week loan? Put it another way, how many years are there in 14 days? Now, do write this down. The way we find the number of years is we take the number of days, in this case 14, divided by 365.25. Don't forget that 0.25, because years, we have to add a whole day every 4 years because the Earth spins a little faster than 365 days. So whenever you're turning days into years, and it doesn't matter how many days, it could be 1,000 days, 2 days, you always divide by 365.25. And I say equals. Put this down in your notes. Don't try to put a rounding in an exponent. Just save that number. The reason is that when you round, you get into rounding error. But when you round in an exponent, you get exponential rounding error, which is terrible. I mean, it can get you wrong answers, seriously. So I just say, okay, see that part where it says 1 over the number of years? I'm going to say 1 over memory recall. 1 over 0.0383 years. Okay? Don't forget to do that. We're going to do these again. So don't have a heart attack. Oh, God, this is a tough formula. No, we're going to do it, and you'll get used to it. Interestingly, Excel has a way, it'll do it automatically for you. But, you know, just to give you an idea. So what we're going to do is we're going to do this little calculation. The ending value is $236.54, was it? Yeah, 54. Divided by how much you borrowed, 200. Close the parentheses. Now we're going to raise that. Open the parentheses, 1 divided by that number of years. In other words, 1 divided by memory recall. Close the parentheses, minus 1. I hit 0 instead of 1? Yeah. So let me do that again just to make sure that you see how that mistake I deliberately made works. What is going on with me today? My God, that is only 18 proof. No, that is coffee. Close the parentheses. Raise that to the open parenthesis 1. Oh, shut up. Divided by memory recall. Close the parentheses. Minus 1. Equals. Now, you want it as a percent? Don't forget to times by 100. Whoa, I did that wrong. Where was it? 78.66. 78.66 times 100%. There's a percentage APR on that loan. Seem a little excessive? People will do it all the time. 7,866% annualized interest rate. No wonder those places are so profitable. They're a money market, but essentially they are charging interest rates. Now understand that there are in countries and have been since time immemorial what are called anti-usury laws. Laws that prohibit you from charging high interest rates. Back in the old days, you would have been shot, hanged, and burned in that order if you had charged an interest rate like that at a bank. But these days, it's okay. In fact, the Supreme Court addressed this some years back. And the Supreme Court said, no, that's not the interest rate. The interest rate is 19.95%. The rest of those are fees. Fees aren't interest. Fees are fees. Showing the absolute stunning ignorance of people who get law degrees without a finance course. They didn't understand that that fee is effective interest. But there you go. That's what happens when these people, and this is, of course, people who are working class, poor, and lower middle class, they are just screwed by these financial institutions that play this game. Now, the one thing that I do want to get covered here is that capital markets are different. Capital markets are the markets for long-term money. Now, when I say long-term, it could be a year, 7 years, 30 years. There are bonds that are 100, 200, 300 years, year bonds. In other words, there are bonds where something or someone is borrowing money for 300 years. They'll pay interest for 300 years, and then they'll pay the $1,000 back, or a multiple of that. What kind of investor would... Madam, are you going to live 300 years? Yeah, you're not, no. What's scary, though, is what I was teaching, like, many years ago, I would have said, are you going to live to be 70? And that would have been the average life. When I say that now, most of you are going to live to be about 100. Some of us excluded, of course. But it's more normal. But still.
After 70, those are the worst 30 years.
Oh, you don't know how bad it is. Let me tell you, when you are so ugly, you have to hang a pork chop around your neck so the cats will like you. Really? Yeah. Okay, that's me. Okay. Why would an investor invest for 300 years? Who, what would invest for periods that long? Yeah?
Someone who thinks the value of bonds are going to go up within their lifetime.
Well, no, because, I mean, you see, that thing doesn't mature for so long.
It's for future people, family members.
I don't give a shit about them. Really, I don't care about my family like that. I like them, you know. I do owe them because, you know, my kids are so messed up from being with me. Possibly, but
would it be a debt seller?
No.
Probably municipalities.
Municipalities need money. They don't. Insurance companies. Think about this. Do you know that we sit right on a fault line right here? The New Madrid. The last time that thing broke was in the early 1800s. The violence of the tremors was so powerful, it threw the Mississippi River water backwards, and then it came back down as a tsunami. It destroyed St. Louis completely, and it wasn't just one earthquake and then a bunch of aftershocks. It was one major earthquake after another after another. The letters from the people who lived in this area, they were writing like science fiction writers in the apocalypse, burning buildings, smoking rubble, dead bodies piled up all over the place. The Native Americans described this as happening many centuries before that. The New Madrid doesn't go every year, every 10 years. It goes every maybe 200, 500 years. So an insurance company that insures against catastrophic losses, they would want to have that money available way, way in the future. Because remember, a corporation lives forever. It has to plan in a way that we as people don't. So, yeah, there are plenty of investors for very long-term bonds. In fact, there are corporations. They aren't going to be mining the asteroids for another 50 years. So we want investors who are going to be willing to wait 50, 70 years. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.